We've been studying what the Bible has to say about how we as Christians can stand firm against Satan, against the devil. And we're looking at Ephesians chapter 6, if you'd like to look there. Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 to 17. And what I wanted to do last time and this time is I want to talk to you about the four ways that Satan specifically lies and attacks us through unbelievers. And there's four ways. We saw two of them last time. Number one, he incites our fleshly desires within us through the unbelieving world around us. We saw this last time. Now, this is important. The principle is this. The external source of temptation is Satan and his demons through the world. And the internal source of temptation are our fleshly desires within us. The desires that well up within us is the flesh. That's not Satan. There's no such thing as a spirit of lust and a spirit of greed and a spirit of anger. The spirit of lust, greed, and anger is us. It's our flesh. Satan cannot put thoughts into our minds. He cannot read our minds. That is a divine attribute. But what he can do is externally tempt us. Satan sets up a playground to tempt you. So many things. And he gets through the world, they set up a society built around fleshly activities. And you know what? Every society is a society filled with fleshly activities. They just come in different forms and different delights. And the more technology you have, the more technological they become. So Satan is continually inciting it. And through the world, he's doing it. So he's going to use every communication device. He's going to use every form of entertainment. He's going to use everything that we come up with. And it's always going to be all the good stuff that we come up with is going to be turned into evil. But we need to understand that so that when we face the struggle, we know where Satan's coming in and where the flesh is. Okay, secondly, he attempts to deceive us, we saw last time. He attempts to deceive us with lies through the beliefs and values of the unbelieving world. Satan knows this, that people are motivated by their beliefs and value system. Therefore, if you want them to work the flesh and get the flesh going and incite the flesh and live by their flesh, they're going to need to value those things and they're going to have to believe lies that it's okay to do them. So he continually perpetrates, and you can see it. Just watch the media. Don't look just at the fleshly activities. Look at the beliefs and values behind it. Because they're espousing them all the time. And look for those lies. And what Satan wants to do with us, he'll try to get us to value something, a benefit that it has, and then to say that benefit is greater than what I'm experiencing now and I want it. Ultimately, that's how he dealt with Eve. He had two basically simple lies. Number one, did God really say that? And number two, you won't die, and God knows that if you do it, you're going to be like him. But when he said that, I don't think that Eve's desire was to be like God in the sense of pride. It was benefit. See, if I'm like God, this is what I'm going to get. You think you have it good now? You want to have it really good? You know? It was a benefit issue. The lies and the values and beliefs are always about benefit. Because you sin to get something. And so Satan works on that. If he can get us to believe the lies, got us. Now we come to number three. He attempts to deceive us with a false Jesus and a false gospel through false Christians. Look in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, 2 to 4. Anybody who studied the New Testament for a while realizes that Paul and the other apostles dealt a lot with false doctrine. From the very beginning, as soon as Jesus left and left his apostles, Satan began spreading his lies. Everywhere they went, false apostles rose up. False teachers rose up. Men and women began mixing philosophy and mixing other religious things and trying to mix everything with Christ and move away from the purity of Christ from the very beginning. And Corinth was no different. People came in. They said, you know, Paul wasn't a real apostle. I'm an apostle and in a general sense, and I have truth from God. And they talked about there's no resurrection of the dead. They talked about all these different things. They rose up, they began to teach false doctrine. Instead of kicking them out, they said, okay, what do I have to say? And they listened to him. Finally, in 2 Corinthians, Paul, he rebukes him in 1 Corinthians. They didn't get the full message. He comes back in 2 Corinthians and gives them another one. And he says in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 2, he says, I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I may present you as a pure virgin to him. He's using a metaphor of a father who takes his bride, and in Jewish times, the father's responsibility was to keep his daughter pure from other men, so that when she married as a pure virgin. And so he shows him giving the daughter to the husband as a pure virgin. That was his responsibility. And Paul says, he uses a metaphor, and he says, me sharing Christ with you and teaching you salvation by grace through faith, that Christ is fully God and fully man and all the basics of the truth. I made you pure in Christ, a pure devotion with Christ in the center. Nothing else. And I handed you over to God the Father and to Jesus Christ with that truth. And these people have come in and they are working to have you commit spiritual adultery. And he says, verse 3, but I'm afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. Here's what Satan wants to do. He wants to add a whole bunch of stuff so you can't see Christ anymore. He wants to put his mom in the way. He wants to put in a whole bunch of other saints in the way. He wants to put a bunch of works in the way. He wants to put a bunch of experiences in the way. He wants to put a bunch of additional knowledge in the way and all this extra ritual and all this stuff so that you can't see Christ anymore. And when you receive the truth about Christ, that He is fully God and fully man, and that it's salvation by grace through faith, it is simple, it is pure. And Satan wants to muddy it all up, get you all confused, add everything. And I know because I grew up in that, and I mean, I'm telling you, there was so much in front of Christ, I couldn't even see Him. Until somebody one day came in and said to me, he was actually speaking at our campus, and said, I want to talk to you about salvation by grace through faith alone. And all of a sudden, like, the Lord just opened up my eyes and I saw it. And He just like cleared the aisle away. And for the first time, there was nobody in front of Christ but Jesus alone. And I accepted it. I saw it. And from then on, I kept everybody out of the way. Because it's Christ and Christ alone we know, and faith in Him. And then he says in verse 4, he gives three ways that Satan deceives us through a false gospel, a false Christ. Look at verse 4. For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, they bring a different Jesus. Secondly, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, they bring a different spirit. Or number 3, or a different gospel, a different way of salvation from the one you accepted. He says you put up with it easily enough, and that's a rebuke. He says you should have kicked him right out of the church and said, what are you doing? You're bearing with it. It's like us telling our kids, hey, what are you doing hanging around with those kids? They're getting into drugs and all this. And what do? You just stand around. Let it happen. Get out of there. That's what he's telling them. You're easily bearing up as if it was no big deal. You know? You shouldn't be. It's wrong. Now let me just mention what each of these things are. False teachers, agents of Satan, bring a false Jesus. What is a false Jesus? It's a false, distorted, perverted Jesus. Satan takes the real Jesus and twists it. Sometimes a little bit twists Him. Sometimes a lot. Until you can't recognize Him. But he'll use some of the scriptures, and he'll talk about believing in Jesus. But it's a false Jesus. For example, Jehovah's Witnesses say, I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe that Jesus Christ is the highest created being that Jehovah God created. He is a son of God, but not the same being as Jehovah God. That's a false Jesus. It's not the real Jesus. Mormons say, I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe that Jesus, who is called Jehovah in the Old Testament, is the firstborn of the spirit sons and daughters of Elohim. This Jesus is now a God, but not the same God as the Father. That's a false Jesus. That's not the real Jesus. The Unitarians say, I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe Jesus was the outer man to the spiritual inner Christ. Because the man Jesus acknowledged God in all of his ways, he was lifted up in his physical body into a perfect state and became God-like as the spiritual took over. The Muslims say, I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe that Jesus Christ was a sinless prophet, but he was not, nor could he be, God come in the flesh, for there is only one God, Allah. Those who would be many religious people, who would we would call liberals, say this, oh, I believe in Jesus. They may say, I believe he was a great religious leader, or they may say he's a great religious teacher, or both. They may say, some say he was a Jewish religious radical, some a hippie, peasant, Jewish guy with a following. But the one thing they won't say he's God. They won't. But that's not the biblical Jesus. The biblical Jesus was fully God and fully man. And notice what Paul says in verse 4. You say, well, how do you know, how do we know we're right about Jesus? People are going to ask you this. I love this question because it's so easy to answer. How do you know you're right? Even you may be talking to somebody who knows people in Christian cults or whatever, and they see it all as just one big blur. How do you know you're right about Jesus? Because we preach, we hold to the apostolic Jesus. Notice what Paul says. For someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached. And he's talking about himself as an apostle. We preached. The only true Jesus is the apostolic Jesus. Every other Jesus, two things are added. Another prophet or spokesman for God, right? Then the apostles. And the second, another scriptures of some form. Some other revelation. They always add. We're the only ones who add nothing. We are the only ones who add nothing to the scriptures. Everybody else adds tradition, or they add some form of revelation from some prophet or special spiritual person. We are the only ones that add nothing to the Bible. We are the only ones who hold to the apostolic Jesus, to the New Testament Jesus. And as I told you before, the New Testament is the New Testament because every single book was written either by an apostle or a close associate of an apostle. And the only reason that these books are in there is because they were written by an apostle or an associate of an apostle. Period. And that's attested very heavily to the by the early church. Sometime I may do a sermon on that one because it's so good. That's the answer. And guess what? The apostles were the personal representatives appointed by Jesus himself. Secondly, he says, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received. When spirit is used in the context of God's revelation in the New Testament, it often has to do with the spirit that is revealing things to the false teacher or the true teacher. And obviously, the spirit revealing to the apostles the truth is the Holy Spirit, and it's contrasted with a different spirit. And what is the spirit that is revealing to false prophets? Demonic. A demonic spirit. So he says, if you fall into false doctrine, you're receiving a different spirit. It is the spirit of the revelation of demons. Number three, or a different gospel from the one you accepted. A different gospel is a different way of salvation. A different way to be saved. And there's many ways that people are saying to be saved. And what they do, they attack Jesus and distort Jesus, and or, sometimes both, sometimes one or the other, and they distort the way of salvation. They add something. They always add something to salvation by grace through faith alone. You say, but how do you know that Satan's in there? Well, look at verse 13. He says, for such men, these are the false teachers, by the way, the ones who teach it. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, masquerading as apostles of Christ, and no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It is not surprising, then, if his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness. Their end will be what their actions deserve. Now, he wants us to understand exactly what we're going to see when we see the false teachers and deceitful workers. For such men are false apostles. They claim to be apostles. They're not going to claim to be the 12, but they claim to be equal to the apostles. Joseph Smith said, I'm an apostle. of the Latter-day Saints. See? So Muhammad took prophet, he took apostle title. They are deceitful workmen. Don't be surprised when they work hard at their deceit. You can't take a sincere person who works so hard and tell me they're going to hell. That's exactly what Paul says. Don't be surprised if they work hard at deceit. And their masqueraders are disguised as apostles of Christ himself. So don't be surprised when they use the term Christ, when they talk about Jesus, when they say they love Jesus, they believe in the Jesus. Jesus is important to them. Even Muslims do that. They say Jesus, absolutely. Jesus is important. He's important. But they're not talking about the same Jesus we are. And he says, don't be surprised, for no wonder Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. And that means that he's coming in and he's revealing to these people as if he was an angel of God. And isn't it interesting that Joseph Smith said he saw an angel of God and Muhammad the same? Don't be surprised if people see things. But I'll tell you this, it's not an angel of light. It's someone masquerading. Because anyone that teaches a false gospel is from the devil himself, whether they appear as somebody from God or not. And guess what? He says, all that stuff's from Satan right there. Satan is building false religion. Makes sense, doesn't it? So we need to hold firm to the truth, and we need to hold fast to the apostolic teaching. Let me just show you one more verse before we leave that. Look at Acts chapter 2, verse 42. And that's exactly what the early church did. They held to the apostolic teaching. Acts chapter 2, verse 42. After more than 3,000, probably about 5,000, because they only counted the men. So there was a lot more than that that accepted Christ that day in the first church. And it says in verse 42, Luke says they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching. It's not they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and. They devoted themselves to a whole bunch of other people's teaching. They knew right away the apostles were appointed by Christ to teach the truth so there would be no error. And then they and the close associates wrote it down. And they gave us the New Testament. And that's what we're devoted to today. How do you stand firm against a false gospel, a false Jesus, and a false spirit? Hold fast to the truth. And we'll see the belt of truth when we get to the armor. Fourthly, and this is interesting, Satan can physically afflict us or ones that we love with illness, crimes, disasters, persecution, and the like. And I divide up in 2 points because I want to deal with persecution separately. The first point is Satan tempts us by afflicting upon us crime or war, natural disasters, or physical illness. This is interesting. Let's turn to the book of Job. The book of Job. Job chapter 1. God is setting up what's going to happen with Job. And so he starts in verse 1 to set up this interaction between him, Satan, and Job. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. The very first thing we learn is that Job was a believer. This is the Old Testament definition of a believer. He feared God. That doesn't mean he's obviously afraid of God. He respected God. He submitted to God. And we would say repent and believe. They use the term fear. And he shunned evil. He repented. He turned away from evil. He was blameless and upright. That is, all the people saw his testimony. He was a godly man. He was also rich. Verse 2, he had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and he had a large number of servants. That was his portfolio. He owned this many that, this many this, this many. Today we'd have property, or we'd have mutual funds, or whatever it is. That's where his wealth was. He also had a whole bunch of servants who generally, you know, were all the workers and taking care of all of them. And he had a big family, which was also valued because they were often your supervisors and they were there when you died and they took over for the family and handed it down. Very important. Notice, too, he was the greatest man among all the people of the East. And that is an expression showing that he was well known and had a big reputation for being rich and also for being upright. Verse 4, now he gives you a little example of just how righteous and how careful he was about honoring the Lord. His sons used to take turns holding feasts in their homes, and they would invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. Now, based on the context and stuff, this one, they weren't partying all the time in a bad way. They were just having fun and enjoying and being with the family and being with their friends. And when a period of feasting had run its course, Job would send, and often they would do it according to the religious calendar. And when a period of feasting had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps, just to take care of, just to make sure, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. I'm not sure about it, so I'm just going to not take a chance. And he would do a sacrifice. This was Job's regular custom. That's how careful he was. The point is this. Bad things do happen to godly people. And God does allow Satan to afflict godly people. Yeah, you can be a godly and you can be living for the Lord and something terrible can happen. And you have to trust the Lord just like everybody else. And you can trust the Lord through it. Verse 6. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. Now, I mentioned before, angels live in heaven, and after Satan and the evil angels fell, they were kicked out of heaven. They could no longer live there. It's like kicking someone out of your house. They can't live there, but they can still come in if you allow them to. And so God kicked all the evil angels out of heaven. They lost the privilege of living in heaven. Big privilege, big privilege. They were stuck in what Ephesians calls, Paul calls the kingdom of the air, which is a spiritual realm around human beings roaming the earth. It's all this atmosphere around us, but it's spiritual, in the spiritual realm around us, which based on us, not that good. Okay? And they were kicked out of heaven. But Satan and maybe some other demons, probably not all of them, are allowed to enter heaven. And we know that Satan does it day and night. He accuses us, right? The Bible says. So he's allowed to come in every day. The idea that God is such a holy God that Satan could never come in his presence is simply not biblical. That's a human idea of holiness. God is so pure, he can't be touched no matter what. Even Satan can stand in his presence and God is not touched by Satan. But Satan is allowed to come before God. Why does God do that? Because he's glorified by it, as we'll see. One day the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. Notice the Lord initiates this. The Lord's always in control. The Lord is the one doing this. To prove a point. He's going to prove something to Satan and all of his angels. And for us too. This is for us. The Lord said to Satan, Satan, where have you come from? Of course the Lord knows. It's just like when you ask your kid, where you been? And you know exactly where they've been. You're setting up the scenario. See? Satan answered the Lord, from roaming around through the earth and going back and forth in it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Okay, stop right there. For all that Job went, wouldn't you like God to say about you, have you considered my servant who has lived for me and loved me? You say, well, I don't know, because then I got to face that. But wouldn't you like God to say that about you? He was a godly man who loved him and honored him. Now Satan, and God is setting Satan up. He wants Satan to do this to prove a point. That no matter what you do to a believer, they will always stand with the Lord if they're a true believer. And that God will strengthen them through it. That's the real test, right? Notice what Satan says. Verse 9. Does Job fear God for nothing? Satan replied, have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? God is protecting him. God protects every one of his children. And anything that happens to us, God allows, because we are part of the curse. We are responsible for the curse, and God's not going to remove the curse in our lives. But what he will do is put a hedge around us so he filters the curse. It's a big difference. But that's good. You have blessed the work of his hand so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. Stretch out your hand, strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. He says, take away, wipe him out completely. Take away all of his portfolio. He says, if you take away everything and you take away his family, everything external to him, he will curse your face because his faith is only based on what you do for him. It's not true, though. And God wanted to show him it's not true. Believers are believers for life. And so the Lord said to Satan, very well then, everything he has is in your hands, but on the man himself do not lay a finger. Now notice, God's protective care is around him. He is just a believer. With unbelievers, Satan has much more freedom. See, why? They're his subjects. But with Christians, we're under God's protective care. As soon as we become a Christian, God begins protecting us. And now Satan has to ask permission to afflict us. He can't just do it because we're God's children. And God is protecting us. Yes, God does allow him at times to test us and build us. See? But God does it. He allows it. And we have to understand that when God does, he gives us the strength because he's protecting us. Until the day he removes it and something happens or you die. He's got to remove it to die. Otherwise, short of the rapture, how are you going to get to heaven? It's the only way. You know? It won't be painful for you. It's just for the people left behind. So, look at this. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. And this is all going to happen in one day. It's amazing how life can change in one day. One day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, okay, this is his portfolio falling apart. The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabaeans, that was a group of people, you know, this was ancient times when somebody could just come in and wipe you out. And you had to have an army, you had to have people ready to fight them off. They were grazing and the Sabaeans attacked and carried them off. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who's escaped to tell you. That's half his portfolio wiped out. Now, the Sabaeans coming down, I look at that as basically a combination of a crime and a war. Because in ancient times, they didn't have wars the way we do. Basically, it was wars anytime I wanted your property and I fought you for it. And if I wanted it, I tried to take it. And we would call it a crime or a war, because it was either. Satan can work, we don't know how, doesn't reveal, Satan can work through unbelievers to afflict you. But notice, while he was still speaking, verse 16, another messenger came and said, the fire of God fell from the sky. That's lightning. The fire of God fell from the sky and burnt up the sheep and the servants. And I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you. That's the third part of his portfolio. He just wiped out his stock in that area. And we know from Revelation that angels do have some power over nature, because it's the angels that bring those curses, that bring the judgments. And so they manipulated the lightning. Does it mean every time there's lightning? No, of course not. There are several different sources. The main source is the earth and the universe being fallen. And so things like that happen, but sometimes Satan can do it too. So you have crime and war, and you have physical disaster. Verse 17, same day, by the way. While he was still speaking, he's just going, one, two, three. Another messenger came and said, the Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and carried them off. That's it. He's got nothing left. They put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you. That's his entire financial portfolio, zero, everything. Everything's gone. Except his family. Verse 18. While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, your sons and your daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind, that's a desert storm, a desert sandstorm, swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house, and it collapsed on them, and they're dead, and I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you. Everything that he valued was gone, except the Lord, which is the most valuable. At this, Job got up, and he tore his robe and shaved his head. He fell to the ground in worship and said, I've got to bind Satan because I know Satan is behind this. No, he doesn't even know who's behind it. The only reason we know Satan did it is because God told us. God doesn't tell us who's doing what. What he did is what we do. We don't identify the source. We trust God through it because God has allowed it. And if God has allowed it, we accept it and we trust God through it. See? We don't need to worry about why or how it happened unless we're responsible. We just need to trust God through it. And that's what he did. He said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. Is it possible for a believer to have everything taken away and still believe? That is what a believer is. Look at all of our brethren throughout history. Now notice Satan comes back and he says in verse 3 of chapter 2, then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil, and he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." God's leading him down a path. "Skin for skin," Satan replied. "A man will give all he has for his own life. You stretch out his hand, you strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." You know, people think Christians are like that. "Oh, you guys are just a bunch of hypocrites. As soon as you get into trouble, you'll break down." You know what? True Christians don't break down. Not that they're perfect, but they trust the Lord. Then the Lord said, "Very well then, he's in your hands, but you must spare his life." Verse 7, "So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job. He afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. So bad that the only thing he could do is take a piece of pottery, and which is just a broken piece, and just scrape himself." If ever you're with somebody who goes through that, you know what? Or you go through it yourself, remember one thing. Jesus went through death on the cross, probably something we will never, and Job went through the worst possible physical illness anybody. I mean, that's as bad as it gets. And yet, trusted God with it. He did that, actually. He wavered a little bit. We all do. But he stuck with the Lord. The lesson of the book is, he wavered a little bit, but God worked and he trusted all throughout. And he did. Because that's what we need to do. Now, I want you to notice, God protects us. Satan can use physical. He can use crime and war. He can use natural disaster. Here's the key, though. Don't identify the source. Do what you always do. Trust the Lord through it. Trust the Lord through it. So Satan can do that, and he does what Paul did in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 and 10. The Lord, he entreated the Lord. He had a messenger of Satan, remember that? A thorn in the flesh. He prayed. The Lord said, "No, I'm not taking it away. I have some purposes in it." He's not going to take it away until it achieves the purposes that he wants. Once it does, he may or may not. It just depends. You might get it all the way into heaven. But remember this. Whatever you experience in heaven is so fantastic and so fabulous and so incredible that it will never, ever be compared. That God can put you through the worst possible thing and you will get to heaven and you'll be thanking the Lord and saying, "Lord, that's all you asked of me? That's it? After all that I have now have?" Can you imagine just having a sense of pure joy every day? Never anything else but just pure joy all the time? That alone I would take. And nothing else. If you just give me that, Lord, I'll be the happiest person forever. I don't care about anything else. I just want that. Lastly, this is the second thing he can do. He can persecute us. We'll close with this. 1 Peter 5. Satan also desires to afflict us, to persecute us, to ridicule us, to mock us so that we'll give up on Christ. Verse 8, 1 Peter 5. "Be controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour." How is he prowling around? Verse 9, "Resist him, standing firm in the faith." There's your armor. Stand firm. He doesn't mention the armor, but same thing. Resist. "Because you know that your brothers throughout the world are undergoing the same kind of sufferings." The context here is Satan is trying to devour them through suffering. And in this case, they were moving in and they were taking away their property and they were feeding them to lions and everything else. The Romans were doing it. Some of the greatest testimonies of faith came from the persecutions. You know? And that's how they do it. And we tend to get it at work. We get ridicule. We want to obey the rules. They don't want to. "Hey, come on, let's do it. We can leave early. It's not a big deal. We can change our time card. Don't worry about it." And if you don't, they ridicule you. But what happens? You got to stand. You got to say something. You may not attack them, but you can say, "You know what? I don't want to really be involved in that." Or you might have to say, "You know what, I got to go." Or if they want you to lie, I've had this, where I was working, I said, "Look, just tell them I'm not here. Look, I can't say that." I tell them straight, I can't lie. So what do? We stand firm.